You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Whenever we think of Vietnam, we always associate music with Vietnam. This song from Apocalypse Now and the Rolling Stones is now become a water skiing song. So who would have thought Mick Jagger water skiing? But thanks to Apocalypse Now, we all do. Anybody who's seen the movie can't forget it. Joining me is a former Marine Corps first lieutenant. Did you get out as a cap? Did you ever make captain?
You know, on the day that they discharged me, they promoted me to captain, and I'm afraid I never wore the bars.
Oh, it's incredible! All of a sudden, you're everybody's buddy. You were a lieutenant, yeah. And they look at you like with suspicion, like, "Yeah, what do you want, lieutenant?" You walk in the next day, you're a captain. They're like, "Hey, skipper, how can we help you?"
I know.
Like, what the hell happened, man? I was the enemy yesterday. Now I'm everybody's buddy.
So, I know.
The exactly, and paraded around. Carl Marlanis, also, I'd be remiss, best-selling author, recipient of the Navy Cross, the Purple Heart in Vietnam, and a Rhodes Scholar. And so he's lived a pretty interesting existence, and now collaborating, and I want you to kind of make it smart about it though, Carl. Collaborating with Ken Burns on his upcoming project that will be released in September. What is it called? And tell us about the event last night in Seattle, of all places.
It was called the Vietnam War, and it's going to be 10 episodes, about 19 hours.
Wow.
So it's an epic film, and they've been working on it 10 years. I've been, in and out helping them. I mean, sort of advising, and I'm a talking head in the thing for the last 7 years. And it's going to knock people's socks off. They start back in 1854 with the French, and they really analyze it from all sides. I mean, they interview North Vietnamese veterans, Viet Cong veterans, South Vietnamese veterans. They interview peace protesters. They interview draft dodgers. They interview Gold Star mothers. I mean, they cover the whole gamut of that time in our nation's history, and it's an important film because, as I was just talking with you, I wrote a New York Times article, and the title of it was "The War Where We Lost Trust," because it was in that time that we switched from almost a naivete about American institutions to a complete cynicism. And the incident was I was at Yale talking with friends in the hall at the 2 a.m. discussions, and they were talking, we were all talking about the Vietnam War, this is 1966. And I remember just sputtering, I'm from this little logging town in Oregon, I grew up thinking just what I said to them. I said, but an American president would never lie to Americans. And they all laughed. And I had never had a response like that. I was like shocked. They don't believe that our president is telling the truth? Well, now you tell somebody that today and they look at you like, are you from Mars? They all lie, Well, as I say, they don't all lie. Some of them lie. And so we have to, instead of switching from complete, Pollyannish sort of view of our politicians to a completely cynical view, it's debilitating. We can't get anything done anymore. Nobody trusts anybody. You can't work like that. Family can't work like that, neither can a nation. And so I think we got to get over it, get back to a center here. And I think this film is going to, there's going to be a lot of dialogue as a result of it. People are going to start talking. And I think that there's a chance for a lot of reconciliation because you're going to see all sides. You're going to see all sides. And believe me, there wouldn't be sides if the other side didn't think they had the right side.
That's confusing a little bit, but I'm following you, which scares me.
Yeah.
It must have been you're living just outside Seattle, yes?
Yes, that's correct.
Why did they choose Seattle for their event last night?
They're doing a sort of a multi-city tour. It debuts on my guest phone going off.
Right.
They do a multi-city tour because they're going to kick it off on the 17th of September. But they're going around to just different, I guess public television markets, promoting it. And last night they had about a 45-minute clip of various episodes. And then Ken and Lynn Novick, who's the director, and myself, we were on the stage and, answering questions.
All right. Well, let me lay out the foundation for your appearance on All Marine Radio here today. First of all, thank you for doing this. I love having you on and your perspective, always. You have an interesting perspective because, on one hand, you'll tell us about fighting, in the highlands, and fighting up and down mountains, using napalm to reveal, enemy positions and then fighting uphill and doing those things. And then, in another breath, you'll tell us about your life as a Rhodes Scholar, and then you bridge the two with stories about your squad leader telling you that you were the stupidest fucking Rhodes Scholar he'd ever met in his life. And so I love having you on because of that kaleidoscope as you turn it, and the way you represent all those different little views of the world. It's very cool to have you on. So thanks for doing this. I was having a conversation with the company commander at Quezon last week, Monday night, I think. And I think he wants to come on, but he's not sure of how the interview will go. And he's not sure if he'll get blamed for different things or what my agenda is. So we were talking. He asked me if I knew anything about My Lai. And I said, well, generally I do, but, and then when I got off the phone, I thought, how the hell do I not know more about My Lai? So I started reading about it. I started watching interviews. I downloaded the investigation. And needless to say, it's a jaw-dropping experience to listen to the interviews that are given to what happened in My Lai and what those guys did. And then to read the investigation and to see the damage and what happened. And then what I've been surprised at, Carl, is when I was initially kind of reluctant to bring the subject up to Vietnam veterans because, you don't want to intrude someplace. But every person that I've spoken to about it has been anxious to talk about it. Some pissed at the way it colored their service. Others telling you that, there's probably more of that stuff that went on that we cared than we cared to admit. Not certainly on the scale of My Lai, because that was absolutely, mind blowing that somebody could do that. But on smaller scales, it happened. And so I've gone down this road because the comment on the Marine Corps right now is on this, has this campaign of keep your honor clean. And he's selling that a lot of times to novices who don't know that they're going to have to live with for the rest of their life that which they do in combat. And your story about a young North Vietnamese soldier that you killed that you didn't have to echoes Maximus's admonition to his cavalry before they charge in the movie Gladiator, what we do in life echoes in eternity. You'll live with that forever. And one of the reasons to keep your honor clean is because the rest of your life is a long time to have to live with things that you shouldn't have done and aren't proud of doing. And so I wanted to have you on to talk about all of that.
Sure.
Where would you like to start in that kettle of goulash?
Well, I you said we were going to talk about My Lai, and so I I think where I started, because I thought about it, I didn't investigate it. In other words, I didn't read the transcript or anything. I just read about it.
Right.
But I had seen the history of warfare is that there are atrocities. It's something that humans do. And that's what I started thinking about. And what got me really thinking about it, and I wrote about this in the book, what it's like to go to war, but it's a good example. We had been in a fight for days. I mean, and we lost, I don't know, 17 or 19 dead by the time this incident happened. And so we'd been fighting, and blood was up, and we were exhausted and the usual. And I was inspecting the line, and a couple of the kids had ears in their helmets. Because we had dead NVA right in front of the lines. And they'd gone down, hacked off ears, and put it in their helmets, in those rubber bands that you have around your helmets to hold stuff.
Right.
Camouflage, mostly. And by this time, I'd seen a lot of carnage, and it actually didn't even upset me. But I knew that was wrong. I mean, it was just desecrating an enemy's body that, you know, had fought a good fight. And so I went up to these two kids, and it was like, oh, God, those kind of bad. And I said, you know, look, we can't do this. I know they killed your friends, but you killed their friends. And we just can't do this. And so I'm going to make you go down and find those bodies where those ears are cut off, and you're going to bury them. That's no fun, because you have to dig a very big hole. Not only that, but we were still taking sniper fire because we were still pretty much under siege. So it was not trivial. I mean, it was, you know, very sporadic. And I went down there with them. And when they started digging those graves, they started crying. And I didn't think about it much then, but later I began to understand what had happened. Is that they suddenly realized that they were burying human beings. And I thought a lot about how do you get somebody to kill somebody? And they always talk about how, oh, you know, boot camp's terrible because you learn to dehumanize the enemy. If you're raised in our culture, which is basically, Christian, Judaic, and increasingly Islamic, but it's all, those three faiths are all linked with one set of commandments, including thou shalt not kill. So a decent kid, Marines are decent kids. I mean, how do you get them to kill somebody when their whole life they've been told not to? Well, you do dehumanize the enemy, and you do it for a reason. You can't kill a human being. You can kill an animal. And that's where the stuff like cowhead, podgy, goop, nip, kraut, all these names that we give to our enemies are a way that we can do what I call pseudo-speciate them. In other words, make them a different species, a false species than being a human being. Now, if I have an animal attacking me and my friends, I can pull the trigger. All right, so I shoot a goop or a haji. I don't shoot a human being. The problem is staying in that state of mind. And you have to be able to be sophisticated enough to know, and this is where I think it comes down to the leadership. And there was a huge, massive failure of leadership in Milay. When you're in the battle and you're killing non-humans, which is the only way you can do it, when the battle is over, you've got to have the psychological strength, sophistication, to say, okay, the battle's over, these are dead people, or these are dead, or these are prisoners who are people, or these are villagers who are people. You remember from the transcripts, those soldiers called those people in the village vermin. They had turned them into another species of animal. And of course it's okay to kill vermin. I mean, geez, you don't want to spread disease, right? You know?
Right.
So that unleashes this enormous killer instinct in us. And all of you guys who are Marines, you know it. I mean, when it comes out, whoa, we're mean SOBs. I mean, you know? So how do you keep it under control? Well, one of the things is that the older you get, the better you are at it. And So, you know, sergeants, lieutenants, they have to be the ones that say, okay, guys, the fight's over. And there need to be ways that they think of getting people back into their humanity. That had failed at Mealeye. And there was even a worse thing going on, which I laid out higher up the chain of command. It had become not just permissible, it had become a good objective to kill as many as you could, the body count thing. That is not a way to fight a war. We don't go to war to kill people. We go to war to defend our values, to defend our families, to, you know, defend, you know, government of, by, and for the people. When that is threatened, we will kill people to preserve it, but we're not killing them to kill them. But in Vietnam, it had become body count. So what's the message to you know, the 19-year-old way down in the ranks? Go get them to kill them. And that was a pervasive part of that war that was just a result of basically of no clear military objectives. There were clear political objectives, but, you know, we took hill after hill and abandoned them. That's pretty tough. So what's left? Body count. So we have an entire sort of system of that reinforces the idea that killing is a good thing to do, not a necessary thing to do to get your job done. It's the objective. And then you have this failure of leadership to bring these kids out of the state of pseudo-speciation and just let people wallow in it. It's the recipe for disasters like Mealeye. And I think that we can avoid a lot of atrocities if we just get just a little bit more psychologically sophisticated about how do you get a Marine into a state of mind to kill somebody, and how do you get him back out as soon as possible? You can't kill human beings. It just goes against every grain in our body. So we do a trick to ourselves, and it's a healthy trick. It's the way we get through it and the way we get our jobs done. And then you have to switch it back off. And that was where it all failed in the line.
Carl Marlanis, my guest. I'm going to read you a quote from George Marshall, and I just as a contrast to the policy of body counts. Our policy is directed not against any country or doctrine, but against hunger, poverty, desperation, and chaos. Its purpose should be the revival of a working economy in the world so as to permit the emergence of political and social conditions in which free institutions can exist. That's George Marshall. And then overlay Vietnam, or not overlay, because it certainly shouldn't be overlaid on that. The body count thing stands in stark contrast to that. I've got an email for you. Mac, always love hearing Carl and his thoughts on war, and especially the human aspect of it. General Mattis has described our fight against ISIS is now in the annihilation phase. How far is that from the body count phase? Is it simply one designation saying that I want body counts as opposed to another commander saying I want an end state? What is the difference? And when Carl saw that, did he have a reaction to it? Sir?
That's a great question. I can't get inside General Mattis's mind. I don't know him, and I know some people who work with him, and they all love him. They think he's a fabulous leader. You know, one could look at that and say, "Oh, that's just killing." But the other way one could look at that is that in order to have free institutions, you know, government of, by, and for the people, and not have a situation where, you know, people running around enslaving and raping and cutting off hands and doing all the horrors that ICE does, you may just have to eliminate them. It's sort of like the mad dog in your neighborhood. It's the way you do it that's important. If the dog's got rabies, the dog is dangerous. And it's not the dog's fault. I mean, those young ISIS fighters have been indoctrinated and basically they've had their brains played with, and they're like all young people. They don't think very much. I mean, including our 18-year-olds. I mean, it's just that's the way kids are. And most of those are young people, and they've been indoctrinated to think that they're doing this for God. and they're in fact not. So if you have the attitude that, look, somebody's got to put the dog down, it's not my fault, but we are going to eliminate the dog, then that's a very different way than I'm going to kill the goddamn dog because I hate him. See, so I don't know where Mattis was on that, but I have a feeling that the way that these fighters are, these ISIS fighters are, they are not going to give up. And in order for the larger objectives of security and freedom and dignity of human life to exist in that part of the world and all over the world, we may have to eliminate them. But I would hope that what Mattis was thinking was that we just have to do this because if we have a rabid dog in the neighborhood, we have to eliminate the rabid dog. I don't blame the dog. And I don't blame those fighters. I mean, everybody, all cowardly, you know, ISIS fighters and stuff. I mean, you, come on. I mean, these are people who are willing to strap dynamite to their chest and walk and kill themselves to get the job done. That's not a coward. That's a very misguided, almost kind of crazy person. But if you have a misguided, crazy dog in the neighborhood, you eliminate the dog. And so the answer there is, what's the attitude with which you're going to eliminate ISIS? I think that's what's important. I don't think you're going to come to peace with them. You're not going to make an agreement with them. What's the agreement? You can have a little part of Syria. I mean, come on. You know, they've launched themselves into a pretty stark either or situation. It's either the caliphate all over the world or they're gone.
You know, but it is a coordinating instruction away. Please report all body counts to my headquarters, you know, every 24 hours. You are a coordinating instruction away from possibly unleashing the same beast that was unleashed in Vietnam.
I think that's possible. I really do. I would have to say that that's possible.
But again, the other thing, you and I have talked about this before, we're different military. We're a professional, all-volunteer force, for better or for worse. I know in a lot of cases worse. But one of the, on the upside, I think, you know, in our profession of arms now, you know, I think there's a lot more emphasis on professional military education and learning. And so I hear... one of the things I was struck with by the interviews relative to My Lai was, and I think part of it might have been protecting themselves, but you know, I assumed that these guys had been in combat for a long time. I'm not sure why. I am sure. What I thought was this was a reaction to prolonged combat, getting a lot of their guys had been killed, and so they took it out on this village. I was stunned to find out that they'd been in Vietnam for 7 weeks. I hadn't even been there 2 months. They'd had 3 killed and 38 wounded, all by mines and snipers. And they were angry, but everybody, I mean, if you're out there, but they're working in a different part of Vietnam than you were. They're working near the coast. And so they're dealing with the Viet Cong, who tended to operate near the coast. The NVA moving in and out, but it was post-Tet. So both the Viet Cong unit and the NVA, they had their asses kicked during Tet, and they were not doing a whole lot of stuff then. And so, so that kind of got me curious. Well, then how did this happen? And so I was astounded when they had their little company order the night before, and Captain Medina says everything in that village is going to be VC or a VC sympathizer. Now.
Yeah.
I told you before.
That's not a person.
I told you before that, you know, I'm not a Yale or a Harvard guy like you are, but I did go to community college in California. And so McNamara says a VC sympathizer, that's a civilian, though, who I've seen, and they're coexisting with the Viet Cong, the NVA sometimes, and the Americans, and the South Vietnamese military and government. All screwing with them. So they sympathize with everybody because they're just trying to get through the fucking day. So, hey, sir, I have a question. VC sympathizer, what if it's a woman or a kid?
Right. Yeah.
And the response was, they'll be at the market. Anybody who's still in the village is VC. Kill them all.
Right. No, that's why I said that there's a big failure in the leadership there. I mean, put the analogy. Suppose that you're moving through villages in Germany in World War II, and then you say, kill anybody who's a German sympathizer.
Right?
That's the entire German population. Of course they're German sympathizers. You know, that doesn't make them targets. You know, that's an atrocity. I mean, that's not what you do. So when you label an entire village EC sympathizers, you've allowed them to not be seen as human beings again. I mean, he should have been punished for that. I mean, that was just, it's just unethical. I mean, I really come down hard on
it. Oh, you know, what's amazing,
flat out wrong.
You're a first lieutenant at that time in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Callie is, for every account, Callie is not much of an officer. He can't read a map. Not respected. Medina calls him his shithead lieutenant in front of people.
Right? Oh God!
Exactly. And so, but in a company, there's probably three or four platoon commanders, a weapons platoon commander, and an XO. So normally there's, you know, going to be four or five lieutenants. Where the hell were they to put their hand up and say, or even after it, say, hey sir, do you have a minute? We'd like to talk to you. Where was the first sergeant? Where were the staff NCOs? Nobody said?
That's right. That was where it was a complete failure. I mean, no one stood up and said, whoa, Captain, you can't label them all sympathizers and kill them. What are you thinking? No one stood up. It's that tacit sort of like, well, I don't want to rock the boat, or I don't want right. to. I mean, it's cowardice.
Right.
I'll own cowardice on my own side often, you know. I mean, there were things that happened. I wrote about it. We decided to not take any prisoners. If I had been more mature, I would have said, no, let's not do that. But I just went along with it. I said, okay. You know, I regret it. I'll take it to my grave. I wish I hadn't done that. But believe me, it's not an uncommon thing to happen. But this doesn't excuse it. No, I agree with you 100%. They were... Those staff NCOs on up should have stood up and said, no, they're not all targets. I mean, look, they're just like you said, they're peasants. They're just, whoever's there, they're going to try to get along with them because they want to just live.
The other thing that's interesting is when they get inserted and then they begin, people start shooting. And then there's nobody there but women, children, and older men. Anybody who's a quote unquote military age male is nowhere near to be found because they're off serving in either the South Vietnamese military or they're part of the Viet Cong and the cadre. So they're one of the two. And so a lot of places in Iraq and Afghanistan, not a whole lot of military age males around. And so, so they start shooting, and then guys said, "Hey, look, these are women and children." And so it was very interesting. My life actually comes to light publicly in 1970, and these guys get interviewed, and they're still very much selling the party line on what they were told to do. 20 years later, though, you hear the things that they say. And it's devastating to listen to it. In fact, the day after this happens, Callie told his platoon to go into this minefield area, and they said no. So he said he'll go in. His radio operator steps on a landmine, and as they're medevacing, he's screaming at Callie, "God's punished me for what we did yesterday. He'll get you too." As he's getting on the bird, another PFC. Who killed a lot of people in My Lai? You know, he's interviewed. He's a black kid and from the South. And then 20 years later, he talks about his 3-year-old son was shot in a gang related event that was going on in the yard across the street. The kid's playing outside in his mother's front yard, and he gets hit in the head with a stray round. He goes out and he picks his son up, and his son's dying. He said, "All I could see was the little Vietnamese kids that I killed, and I knew God had taken his revenge on me." And living with that kind of burden is, to me, what you don't know when you're young. is that it will echo through eternity. There is a reason to keep your honor clean, and it's nothing hokey or sanctimonious. You will live with it forever, and it will eat you up in some cases, kill you in other cases, depending on what you did. So the question that I've come to, and I'm fascinated by this, was Vietnam different? Was your war different than any other war, or was it simply different in its own unique way and as much the same as any other conflict in its differences, if that makes sense?
I don't think it was that different. My father, my uncles were World War II veterans. I mean, they talked about murdering their own officers who they thought were incompetent. Okay? I read an incident, it's in Atkinson's trilogy, the Liberation trilogy, but it's the one, I guess, called Day of Battle, where an Army sergeant machine guns 20 German prisoners. What they did is they transferred him to Egypt and the press covered it up. This sort of stuff goes on. I mean, there's World War I stories of troops, you know, slaughtering prisoners. We're a very cruel species. I mean, like I tell people, I say, we're not the top animal on the food chain because we're nice. There's a mad, demonic side to us, and civilization is about trying to keep it under control. And that's what something like Keep Your Honor Clean is trying to do. It's trying to say that the better half of us, see, we're not just bad. We're bad and good. And the better half of us has to have some help. And something like the Commandant saying Keep Your Honor Clean is a means of trying to check this mad monkey, as I call him in Matterhorn, that can come out. You got to keep him under control. You got to keep him in check. And that's what professional warriors can do. I mean, samurai practiced flower arranging and tea ceremony. They did that because they were trying to reinforce the side of them was trying to keep their honor clean. And they were pretty fierce warriors. But if you look at the way they were trained and their code, if the old story is that there was a man who, one of the samurai who had to kill a guy who had killed his lord, and he got him in a position, and he was about to make the final stroke, and he sheathed his sword, and they asked him afterwards, why did you do that? And he said, because I was angry at the man. You don't kill him in anger, or you try not to, and so I think all wars, if you read about them from, you know, ancient times forward, there's been this struggle between, you know, how do you kill the enemy for hopefully legitimate reasons and not involve yourself in the anger, in the self-righteousness, all the pitfalls that you can involve yourself in. And try to remember as soon as you're done that it's a tragedy. I mean, you're there killing them, and they're killing you, and you had nothing to do with being born in America, and they had nothing to do with being born in Afghanistan. But if you're a good kid, and you think that your country is at stake, and you need to be called up and do your thing, well, off you go. You got to remember that they have the same thing going on for them. But when you're in it, and you're up against them, it's a tragedy that you have to fill out your role, and we think that this is the way we want to live our life, and if you want to stop us, I'm going to stop you. That's a very different attitude. It's difficult to keep, but then again, that's why I say that the older you get, the better you should be at it. And these atrocities, I think if we had more, like you say, some staff sergeant should have just said, Skipper, I don't think so. That would have broken the whole thing.
Right. Right. We can't do that. And we're not going to do that. I won't do that. And you had individual soldiers that said, I'm not doing it. In fact, there's one soldier wounded that day. Where do you think his gunshot enters his body?
I don't know.
In his foot.
Yeah. He just said, "I'm out of here.
I'm out of here." And yeah. And he shoots himself in the foot. When I saw the picture of it, I thought he did that on purpose. And then who the hell did I have on told me? I watched an interview that said, yeah, the one soldier that's wounded, self-inflicted gunshot wound to his foot. He just said, I can't do this. I got to get the hell out of here. Carl Marlan is my guest. I want to ask you about leading in Vietnam. We associate racism, drugs, and rape with Vietnam. Rape certainly a part of what happened in My Lai, which is to me astounding. I'd like you to comment on that.
First of all, I don't know. I mean, this is just personal, really personal, but I don't see how you can get it up in a situation like that. I mean, that blows my mind. I mean, it's just like, that just doesn't seem possible to me. But the Vietnam War was different. It was the first war that had press everywhere that was pretty unfiltered. They could send back stuff. I mean, I think rape has gone on in every war that's ever been fought. And it's not even close to a majority of the people. It's a tiny, tiny minority of the soldiers that get involved in it. But if you are in a situation where that's news, and it is certainly news, then you're going to start to get a sort of an image of a war that the other wars didn't have. But I think the other wars didn't have it simply because it wasn't reported. I think it was sort of followed about the same. So the rape thing has been part of warfare, since Alexander, and it's an evil part of it. And I think it just allows a certain type of person who wants to just do that the opportunity. I mean, you can get away with it. You can even say that they were enemy sympathizers and they deserved it. I mean, it all adds up. So I think it's something that we really have to watch. And again, leadership is important. The drug thing, America about 1965 on, had started getting into drugs in a really big way. I mean, marijuana was the beginning of it, and peyote, mescaline, LSD. I mean, that became sort of popular. The military reflects the society. The kids that are in the military came from, high schools and colleges where kids were starting to use drugs. We, in the bush, did not have an issue with it. It didn't happen. And I'll say to this day that it didn't happen. I can remember we got a replacement kid, and a kid came in off the chopper. I signed him, and that night I heard thump, plump, and the next morning this kid's got a black eye and a missing tooth. What happened to you? Fell in a hole, sir. The usual answer. So I got the squad leader aside. I said, "What happened?" And he said, "The guy lit up a joint. We took care of it." Because you can smell a joint, hundreds of yards away, and you can see the glow. I mean, it's like it was really dangerous, and you don't want somebody on marijuana being on watch. I mean, it's bad. It's dangerous. And the kids took care of that kid. And he never smoked another lit the pot, as far as I know, out in the bush again. But when you go back to the rear areas where your lives aren't at stake, yeah, the pot came out. So did the alcohol. Some people were from cultures where they called them that. They were the juicers and the dopers. It was just the culture you brought into the Marine Corps with you. Were you a surfer from California, or were you an Okie from Muskogee? I mean, one of them is going to be drinking alcohol, and one is going to be doing marijuana. The heroin stuff was really, really a lot less. But in the rear areas, it was as rife as alcohol. And again, it got reported. I mean, that's what the stories came out from the rear areas. And I've heard of people saying, "Oh, I was high on marijuana when I was out on patrol." I'm like, I don't know. I don't think you were out on patrol very often, because you wouldn't have lived very long, and we didn't tolerate it. Not just us officers. I mean, right down to the lowest PSC, your life was at stake. So the drug thing was a rear area phenomenon that was real. And I think it would have been real in World War II if marijuana had been being smoked back in the States.
I'm curious about you guys get painted. You know, this is right in your period of service in Vietnam and post-Vietnam, My Lai comes out. Did the My Lai story impact you? Because it certainly colors the service of a lot of Vietnam veterans in the eyes of much of the public.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, when it came out, I was already back. Like you said, I think it came out in 1970.
Right.
I was embarrassed. I felt personally slimed because it did reflect really badly on Vietnam veterans. And, I feel there's a kinship with anybody who's fighting on your side, Army, Navy, whoever it is, Marines.
Right.
I was just so, I have to tell you, I was glad it wasn't the Marine Corps. I mean, because I just had that pride. We've done bad things, but it wasn't that bad. It affected me seriously. I felt personally, slimed. And, it made me feel like, gosh, some of the guys on my team really did let us all down. I took it personal. I can't say anything else about it. I mean, in my brain, I'd be like, well, I had nothing to do with that. It wasn't, 100 miles near. It wasn't even there at the time. I mean, but somehow they're part of the team. And when the team does that, well, it redounds back on your head somehow. And I felt bad.
I told a story. In fact, I just had a guy named Ken Rogers on who produced a documentary about Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 26 Marines at Khe Sanh, which, holy shit, man, what those guys went through. Then I've got an email. Let me do the email first, and I'll tell you back his comment because it brought something you said to me vividly to mind. The email says, hey, Mac, forgive me for not knowing. Could you ask Carl what were his years of service and where was he geographically located in Vietnam and who did he predominantly fight? So, Carl, could you kind of lay out the where you were, what years, and who you fought against predominantly?
I got there I think it was early October of 68, and I was in the mountains right where the Laotian border and the Demilitarized Zone met. I mean, we were within a click or two of the DMZ or the Laotian border, high in the mountains. I mean, the hills we were on were hills with numbers like 1306, and, so 4,000 or 5,000 feet up in the air. It got cold at night. I mean, it was like people would joke. It's like, we're in Vietnam. We're supposed to be dying of heat stroke, and we're out there shivering. And we fought the NVA exclusively. I have always been grateful that my war was, if it moved, you could shoot it, because there was nothing else there except Marines and NVA. And I didn't have these horrible moral dilemmas that the guys down in the flatlands had, where they were intermingling with civilians. They were going through villages, farming areas. Is a little girl coming up to you with a basket going to give you an apple, or is there a hand grenade? I mean, I never had to deal with that. I escaped a lot of that moral issue that was such a huge part of that war. And I got out, 13 months later.
I'll read you one more email. Mac, it seems to me that Carl is echoing what I heard yesterday with General Lynch's comments about leadership is leadership. The comment that Ken Rogers made about somebody picking up a femur, tying it to his web belt, and then one of the leaders of the platoon walking up to him and saying, get that off your body, is exactly the kind of rudder steer that I would think everybody needs in this situation. And if you don't have that, if you're left to your own devices, I think Carl is a great kind of ambassador for the dilemmas.
him being very honest about shooting a soldier that he should have taken prisoner and going to his grave with that regret. It's very, very interesting, and I think you make the point very well about the reason you need to keep your honor clean is not altruistic. It's pragmatic. It will visit you every day should you not. And those interviews with those My Lai guys, especially the guy who lost his son thinking that God took his revenge, is just heart-crushing when you hear it. Thanks for doing this. It's really interesting. I think it brings out the very pragmatic side of leadership in combat and the importance of teaching it to young people. I appreciate Carl's candor very much. It's always awesome when he's on the program. The Ken Rogers was just talking about that, going out on a patrol, and him saying that you know, somebody picked up a femur. There was bodies decomposing. They walked up. They trying to check it out. And they, as they began to move, he said it was all muddy. And his Ken up at Quezon was his experience was similar to you in that, you know, fighting the NVA constantly. And how far were you from Quezon?
Well, we roamed around. I mean, we were always moving, but at the most southern point of our area of operations, I guess we were probably about 6 or 7 kilometers north of Quezon.
Okay, all right. But one of the things, you know, Ken said, you know, in that situation, we did the best that we could do. And I remember hearing one time you've been on talking about how you've made peace with that which is your war experience. And you said, look, I can't control what the United States government did. I can only control what Carl Marlanis did. And I certainly have regrets, but I've learned to live with that. And I heard it again, if you can believe this. Over the weekend, I found interviews with Japanese survivors of Iwo Jima. Now, I've never heard an interview from anybody who survived on the Japanese side. And I probably heard, and at the end, one of the guys was a combat correspondent. And after he was released by the Americans and went home, you know, they couldn't talk about it. You couldn't tell anybody that you had surrendered. You know, let your family be. So that stuff was locked up. So he wrote. He wrote and wrote and wrote. And so he's very, I don't want to say he was philosophical, but he looked and he said, what was the purpose of all of it? Were there death in vain? I could never think that about the men I served with, that they all died in vain. And then at the end he says, the only thing I can say is we did our best. We were put in a hopeless situation. There was no intent to reinforce or help us. And we died there in tunnels. In the end, they flooded the tunnels and filled the, and then put gasoline on top of the salt water and then lit the gasoline on fire to either drown us or burn us out. He said that's what I lived through. And the only thing I can say is that we did our best. So it's a very interesting kind of theme as people make peace with it, Carl. And it vividly brought to me to mind your wrestling with your own experiences and how you do make peace with it and the requirement to keep your honor clean. Hell, it's even in our song, for God's sakes. Did they know all the way back then?
Obviously, yeah.
Yeah, and is that what they were talking about? Did they really? Come on, they're Marines. I thought it was just like, well, it just rhymes with something. Hey, this will fit. Keep your honor clean. Yeah, but maybe there was more to it. It just to me, it's very riveting discussion. How you make peace with it, and then also Vietnam wasn't different. Vietnam had the same challenges that every conflict had, and where there's weak leaders, you have bad things happening. And where you had strong leaders, I have audio of General Zinni talking about going back, and he saw scalps in somebody's cover. He said, I grabbed it out of his head, I threw it in the fire, and then said, this shit is not going to happen around. And he said, it's interesting, because his comment very much parallels yours. So when you hear him tell the story, your thought is, well, what did the Marine say? Did he look at you and say, you know, you don't know shit? And he said, they looked at me with relief in their face.
Yeah.
Almost the exact parallel emotion that you describe in your book when they're burying those dead NVA soldiers that they've taken their ears from them. The same emotion.
Yeah.
Interesting. Tell me more about your thoughts on this whole samurai thing, this weaving back and forth in and out of, we do humanize them here, and yet we need to come back from that. Is there a way that we can do it better? What should we
do? Oh, yeah. I think there is certainly a way you can do it better. First of all, you need to make the mechanism conscious. You need to tell guys in boot camp, I don't know, do they still do pugil sticks?
Yes.
We did pugil sticks. Okay. I mean, when I did pugil sticks, I'd get out there and I wanted to kill that guy. I mean, you know, and he's a friend of mine, you know, but out came the monster. And that's a perfect time right there where they sit and ask, okay, did you feel that? Did you feel that what came out? Now that is what's going to allow you to kill the enemy. But now you've got to understand that he's still your friend, right? Afterwards, you're not going to think that way of him. Otherwise, you'd kill him in the squad bay. Okay, we're not doing that. So right there is the beginning of teaching the mechanism. This is what happens. It's okay when you're doing pugil sticks or when you're in combat. You want this. This is what's going to keep you alive. But you got to remember getting back to the squad bay. The war is going to be over. We're going to start, buying shirts from Vietnam. I mean, it's astounding. So you're going to have to learn about it. So first of all, teaching it so that it's conscious and you're aware of the mechanism. The second thing is, I think, rituals. Rituals are important because they are a non-language way of truth. It's just like poetry. I mean, a ritual, and what I'm thinking of for sure, is just burial of the dead. We took those NVA bodies and threw them into the down the hillside or over the edge of the cliff. We didn't do anything with them at all. What we should have done is, line them up and bury them decently. It doesn't take much. Put a marker on it so that later on, if we abandon the area, someone could find them, with their dog tags. It wouldn't have taken much to treat them with some respect. And the other rituals that you can do is immediately after combat, you can do rituals of your own about guys that you lost. It brings back the fact that now we're human again. And, I'm not talking about anything, when I've got 21-gun salutes or anything. I'm just saying just the decency of lining these bodies up, putting their dog tags where their friends can find them eventually so they won't be missing in action forever,
right.
And putting some dirt over the bodies. That they didn't say a prayer. I mean, these people died. We participated in this part of the tragedy, and now we're going on to our next job.
We do that now. We do memorial services probably about 10 days after somebody's killed, I was astounded to learn that you guys didn't, you never did anything like that.
No. We'd throw them on their choppers and that'd be the last to see of them, our friends. We often didn't know if they lived or died.
Right. Yeah, but somebody in the battalion did.
Yeah, but no one told us.
That's bullshit. Another
It was just the way it was.
Right. Yeah. I understand. Mac, what unit was Carl with?
Charlie
1-4. Charlie, the 1-4, they're the professionals. Were they the professionals back then?
They called us the China Hands back then.
The China.
And because Ford Marines were the Chinese, it was in right. Shanghai right. with the China Marines.
Another email. Hey, Mac, I'm curious, were there senior guys in Carl's company and battalion that were Korea World War II guys? If so, what was that like?
Not at the company level. I mean,
right.
We were all really young. I mean, the company commander was 1 year out of USC. He was fraternity president of USC the year before. There were Korean veterans and World War II veterans. The regimental commander was a World War II veteran. He'd been in the South Pacific, And, but you know, the thing is that we had no contact with them at all. We were out by ourselves, 25 kilometers away from battalion. So we never saw any of these officers out in the bush with us. It was, and so there wasn't much, holdover. I talk about it in my book, the one holdover from the Korean War was one that was not advantageous to us, but a Korean War veteran came out and told us that we had to build, overhead, protective shelters over our fighting holes, because to fight against artillery. We argued with this guy, saying that they're not going to waste any artillery shells on us, and if we enclose ourselves, we won't be able to hear the enemy coming up on us, and we have to move in a couple days anyway. And we had a lot of arguments about it, and the guy was just adamant, no, you have to protect against artillery. Because he'd been in Korea, and they, of course, had been under artillery fire.
Right.
But believe me, the NVA didn't get you with artillery. They got you with orders. And it would have been nice to have some shelter. So anyway, that was the one thing that a Korean War veteran did, and I still think he was wrong. But he just is looking at it differently.
Well, it sounds like he probably got there towards the tail end of Korea when they were in stationary positions, right, facing each other along the DMZ, which ultimately would be the DMZ, and they were shooting the shit out of each other. And, okay, well, I guess in a static position it does make sense, but we're not there.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think that's right. But it was unfortunate. I think part of the problem was that these guys who did have experience. I mean, Lew Wald was the big general.
Right.
He was the head of the I can't remember what they call it, the Marine Amphibious Force, I think, back down in Da Nang. And he was a lieutenant in World War II in the jungle, and I think he got it. He really did, and he'd argue with Westmoreland all the time about that. I always took my hat off to Lew Wald. I think he had it right. It didn't translate down to us out in the bush. We were just too far away. And I will fault these guys. They never came out and visited. Now that happened to be just our battalion. I mean, there were others that were, the officers were better, and the senior officers. I'm talking about lieutenant colonels on out. They usually just didn't see them. But I can remember one guy, again, a World War II veteran, was an Army guy named Stillwell. He was a three-star general.
Right.
We were in the middle of effing nowhere, and it was Christmas, and we hear this chopper. You can hear them down below you because they had to climb up to where we were, and they're below cloud level. The clouds are underneath us. And what in the world is going on? Who is that? We couldn't get them on the radio. We didn't know what frequency they were on, and there's this Huey kind of comes climbing up over the top of the trees. That's the way they creep up these mountainsides without killing themselves. And out steps, I'm not kidding you, Santa Claus and a three-star general. And they were Army guys. We were blown away. And it was this General Stillwell. He had been a lieutenant in World War II. And he just knew what it was like to be out there all by yourself. And he came out and visited. I will take my hat off to this guy. They're at the end of my day. But really rare. And I'm embarrassed to say it was an Army general.
No, you know what? It's what else are you doing if you're not out there, if you're in combat and you're not out there going to see your guys that are in contact with the enemy?
Well, if you really want to know what else you're doing, you're down at the old club. That's what you're doing.
Oh, man. I just can't, and I've been lucky, the leaders I've seen. I don't think we're like that. I don't think that we're like that anymore. I think we're a very, very different. Those guys grew up in the old, you know, the post exchange and the old club and all that. That shit doesn't exist anymore. And
I know it's changed.
It's, you know what I mean? I think we're different. I mean, I've heard guys tell stories of Westmoreland and his what are those silver trailers that he had down in Saigon and his white coated, you know, servants that served him. And you're just like what?
What? Yeah. I know. No, but you got to remember. I mean, we're talking about the U.S. military wasn't paid well. And the way that they got paid was they had perquisites, like servants. I mean, they had, you know, PFCs out painting the rocks in their gardens. And that was the perks you got for being a career officer back in, like, 1935. And that was the way it was in World War II. My dad was a second lieutenant, and there was a very definite hierarchy. My mother tells me once that she was out in Gatesville, Texas, just outside of Fort Hood, and she and a couple friends of hers were wearing shorts because it was really hot. And, you know, and she's from Pacific Northwest and didn't think anything of it. And the colonel's wife just went ballistic on him. Like, you can't walk around town looking like this. You're the wives of officers. And my mother told her, said, I didn't join your goddamned army. You know? But you see, the attitude was really right. Different. I mean, it was class structure. These were like aristocrats, right?
Right?
That's the way that they looked at things. And Westmoreland came from that culture. So yeah, he had servants and, you know, I mean, look at, I'd go aboard a Navy ship. I was on that hospital ship and there was, you know, in the wardroom, they had Filipino stewards. Right. It was like going on a cruise ship, you know, right. And mahogany tables and, drinks and it was like, but that was a leftover from what a class structure. I mean, I get on my high horse. I think we ought to just eliminate that class structure. I think everybody goes to boot camp. Everybody's enlisted. And then once you put 2 years in or whatever, then you strike to see if you want to go to a service academy or to OCS. And you know, then you just go on from there.
You know what, Carl, that's how the Israelis do it. And the Israelis.
That's exactly how the Israelis do it.
Yeah,
they start out, everybody starts out at the beginning.
Right.
And that eliminates a lot of that class structure. I mean, let's face it, you got people that go to college, they get to go to OCS. Well, how come they get to go to college? And in large part, a lot of it is because they come from backgrounds that allow that to happen, as opposed to some kid that grew up in some trailer someplace.
Right.
There's no difference in the intelligence. So no, I think that if I was a commandant, I'd just say everybody goes to boot camp and everybody has 2 years. And after 2 years, if you think you want to be a career Marine, then strike for the Naval Academy or OCS, and you know, then you can move your way into being an officer. I think it would help a whole lot. I love this story. You heard the story about when everybody's standing in formation, and the sergeant's out in front of the platoon, and the officer's coming down to inspect everything, and so the officer sees the sergeant's face, and the PFC sees the sergeant's ass. You don't know until you're in the PFC's position.
Right.
You don't know. And I think it's really, I think we need to go the way the Israeli army does.
No, I mean, they certainly, I used to have that conversation when I was teaching at the infantry officer course. Why are you here today? What entitled you to lead? And the truth is your college education.
Like, that's exactly right.
Those of us who've been to college, except places like Yale, and we know it doesn't. I mean, who do you know that flunked out of college that didn't drink their way out of college?
Exactly.
Nobody. Nobody. You know, nobody flunks out of college. It's easy. All you got to do is show up and guess and guess halfway decent on most of the questions. And if you watch Double Jeopardy, you could probably have like a 3.0. You know, I think if you watch Jeopardy on a regular basis, you can get a liberal arts education at most places in the United States. It's a sad truth. Yeah. It's a sad truth. I'm convinced of it.
A little cynical, but I don't like point.
Yeah. I was serving on the USS Ranger as the executive officer of the Marine Detachment back in the day when we still did that. And, the chief engineer was a Mustang. And one day he threw a fit because his laundry came back and it wasn't folded. And I remember sitting in this meeting, the meeting of all the ship's department heads, and I would go as the second in charge of the Marines. And I'm a first lieutenant. I'm like a little fly on the wall. And he throws a fit. He goes, you know, God damn it. There used to be a day when we had traditions in this Navy. right? The war room was something special. You request permission to enter. You just didn't walk in. We had beautiful tables, and we had silverware, and we had, and then he kind of looked around and didn't finish the sentence. I did, but he probably went, he's going to say Filipino stewards at the time.
Exactly.
And, right? And he said, no, I don't need to get my clothes folded. What kind of shit is this? And I remember thinking, holy shit, man. This is crazy. Hell, as a Marine, you're just happy you got half your clothes back, you know? And right? And that's why you went down to work in the laundry, so you could make sure that you got your shit back, you know, in one piece. To think somebody was going to fold it for you? Are you kidding me? That just increases the probability that they're going to steal your shit. So,
yeah.
But it was...
See, that kind of stuff was left over from, like, the 15th century.
Right.
I mean, that's the way aristocrats went to war. And that stayed in it. Like I said, I think when they finally started changing things, all volunteer military, they had to start paying people sort of competitively with the industry. And those kinds of perks, you know, you don't need them anymore, for sure. It kind of changed. I don't regret it a bit. No. I was from the other side of the fence.
A final question, and I'll let you go. I certainly appreciate your time today. It's an email question. And, Mac, I want to go back to Milai, if we could, for a second. What was Carl's reaction to Callie's sentence being commuted and then Medina being found not guilty and nobody else being court-martialed? I find that an insult to the guys who fought, to think that you could do that shit and get away with it. I heard you play Medina's comments about him being innocent. His statement afterwards that he didn't see any bodies, he didn't know anything, in spite of the helicopter pilot who saved those 12 people, who said he saw Medina personally walk up and shoot a young Vietnamese girl in the chest and kill her. I'm curious what Carl thought as a member of the American military at the time when all that stuff was going on. That's pretty disgusting, the way those guys, nobody gets punished, essentially. Kelly gets convicted, and then, you know, he's confined to Fort Benning under house arrest in the VIP quarters with his girl visiting him every night. Your thoughts as you saw that?
Well, first of all, I think that they should have been punished, all of them. They should have been punished up even higher than Medina. I mean, the whoever was in charge of the Americalda, they should have gotten at least a letter of reprimand,
right,
and had his career ruined, because the all pervasive sort of attitude that this is allowable is ultimately, it's the same as the general who, I don't remember what her name was in charge of Abu Ghraib.
Right.
You set a tone as a leader, and the tone that was set for Abu Ghraib was it's okay to do this shit. And the tone that was set in the Americal division was it's okay to do this shit. So that goes right up to the top. But those more directly involved, they should be punished, but it's the same way that you have to kill somebody in combat. These people are human beings who made horrible mistakes. And you punish them with compassion. It's like, I'm sorry, you're going to go to Leavenworth for 40 years, and I am so sorry that this is going to happen, but if we don't maintain this discipline, it's going to happen again too easily. Oh, well, if the politics are right, I can get away with it. The politics can never have anything to do with it. This is something that is punishable, severely punishable, and you carry out the sentence and you punish. But you don't punish saying, oh, you're an evil son of a bitch, or you are lower than dog shit. I mean, you punish with a sadness that is, I am so sorry that you lapsed and you got yourself into this pickle, and now you're going to pay. I wish it hadn't happened. Again, it's a tragedy. But no, absolutely, I'm with the guy that wrote the email. Those people should have been punished really severely and not condemned, because we're all weak and we can all make mistakes.
It's interesting that the guy who landed his helicopter, a guy named Hugh Thompson, was a chief warrant officer one. He lands his little, they can't figure out why these people are getting killed, because they don't hear any Kalashnikov And you know how your ear gets finely tuned to the sounds of
you know the difference real easily between that and M16, yeah.
Right? And you know if it's pointed at you or if it's not, right? You can hear the difference.
Yeah.
And so he lands his little Kiowa and he walks over to the lieutenant and you know he sees that they're killing civilians. And again, the final death toll is between somewhere around 490 civilians that get killed. And so he goes over to this lieutenant, how do I get these people out of this bunker? And the lieutenant looks at him and says, not Callie, but another lieutenant in that company, Charlie Company. And he says, probably with hand grenades. So he walks back to the helicopter and says, I'm going to go get these 12 people. If they, points at the American soldiers, start shooting, he said, kill them. And when you see the interview with him, it's just, and the door gunner gets asked in this panel, how old were you? He said, I was 18 when he gave me that order. And then Thompson says, thank God it never happened. He said, but I was pissed. I couldn't believe that what was going on was going on. And what I was seeing Americans do. And it's really interesting. And really, that's how the report gets to the division level, because everything inside the battalion kind of gets crushed. Medina tells his guys, do not talk about this. The battalion commander doesn't go visit, doesn't go see it. But when it comes from outside the battalion to the division, now they got to do something. So they go, the chief of staff goes and talks to Medina's 30 or 40 of Medina's guys and says, did you guys see anything? And they said, no. So he goes back, makes a verbal report, and that's the end of it. Which is disgusting, amazing, because I think one of the things you learn after you fight is that the staff judge advocate is there, right, as an admonition to everybody to keep your honor clean, because we will investigate it, and when you take that protection, which is a self protection away, and you get into the world of murder and not killing, you know, in combat for your country. That's a life sentence to torment. So, first of all, thank you very much for coming on and doing this today. I love having you on, and
pleasure.
Love your candor, and can't wait to see you on the big screen here in Vietnam. Now, are you going with the facial growth? Are you clean shaven? How are you? How do you come off with all of this?
I think I just sort of look like an old man, you know. That's what I am.
All right. Carl, thank you very much for the visit. Always appreciate it. Have a great day.
Yeah, thanks very much. Talk to you later.
You bet.
Bye.
That is Carl Marlanis. I'm getting hate mail. Mac, I'm starting to hate you. You have the best job in the world. Simply listening to you converse with Ken Rogers and Carl Marlanis this morning is making me not like you right now. That's bullshit. No, it is a cool job. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come right back. We'll wrap things up. Tell you about what we're doing tomorrow here on All Marine Radio. So, again, my thanks to Carl Marlanis for joining us this morning. Awesome stuff. And you know, their candor is, to me, that's really cool. But, again, what I find, I think when you're young, keep your honor clean is something that you're going to do for the Marine Corps. It is such a selfless act, because you got to be able to live with it, bro. You got to be able to live with it.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. Battlemug.com.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
All I can say about militarybyowner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Couple of emails, or one email and then a comment. You know, this notion of post-combat related mental health, here's one of the comments, of which I have two. You're getting a chance to hear it on a daily basis. And I love the way, on this station anyway, that we tell it. It's not like this separate piece of your life that you deal with. You know, Carl Marlanis just talked, and Ken Rogers' story is perfect. in well-led units, right? Rogers is 21-year-old Lance Corporal, right? In and amongst 18 and 19-year-old young Marines. Somebody picks a femur out of a stack of bodies, right? Puts it on his war belt as they continue patrolling. And within short order, a leader walks up to him and says, hey, get rid of that. And what you're doing is you're pulling him back, right? You're pulling him back from the edge. And Marlanus talks about seeing ears and made them go find the bodies that they took them from and made them bury them. And they were crying as they did it. The sad part is if you don't have leaders like that, if you don't tell those raw stories, that you get what you get. So, again, I think the whole keep your honor clean thing needs to be told in a much more vivid fashion. It's a selfish act. You're doing it for you. The Marine Corps is a collateral beneficiary of it. But part of you taking care of you is living what you do, living with what you do. So, an email. Mac, I agree with you. I'm a bit stunned at the president's announcement today. I do think, though, earlier you made a very important point. The DOD is a warfighting organization. The whole transgender thing is not a very stable person. That person is reinventing themselves, refinding themselves. How in God's name would they ever be expected to deploy? And should the DOD be charged with shepherding somebody through that over the course of, let's just say it's a 6-year process? Is that fair? I think we all know the answer is no. It'll be interesting. Yeah, you know, stand by for the tsunami of shit that the president's going to take. Is it your right to be part of the military? The answer, in my opinion, is no. It's not your right. One more email. Mac, did I hear Carl Marlanus say, I don't know how you could even get a hard-on under those circumstances to rape anybody? Question mark. Yeah, that's what he said. And then the email goes on. Holy shit, man. One more reason to love All Marine Radio. You're not going to hear that interview in very many places. And you're not. That's classic. But he's right. Like, how the hell could you do that? You're on patrol. You got all your shit. Right? Anyway. All right. That'll do it. We're going to talk more mental health tomorrow than treatment options. So we'll do that tomorrow. Anyway, thanks for listening today. My thanks to two great guests, Ken Rogers and Carl Marlanus here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. We're a little late. Have a great day. This program repeats itself, so don't touch that dial.